Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies and, more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is Brian McNeil, who's COO and co-founder of Stringer, which has created a marketplace around the creation of localized video. So we talked to Brian from our studio in San Francisco about the trends he's tracking and the best practices he's exercising. So here's our discussion with Brian. So Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot to talk about, including kind of diving deeper into some of those things I just mentioned. But first, let's start with a quick intro for you and for Stringer, for those unfamiliar.
Sounds good. So in the background, Stringer was founded about 5 years ago, and we provide video to media organizations. But the way we do so is sort of unique. We have a network of over 100,000 videographers who have signed up to our platform, who have our app installed on their iOS or their Android device. So what this means is a media organization, take, for example, NBC News, who needs a video of some sort of breaking news event, say a protest in Illinois, they can drop a pin on a map and request that video. Right, then a push notification goes out to everybody nearby. And those folks can choose to accept it, shoot video of that protest and upload it. And then NBC sitting back in New York can then view that video and purchase that video. And when they do so, the original videographer gets paid. So what we've done is basically make the process of sourcing video much more efficient and much more rapid than has been done before.
Absolutely. That's great. There's so much there that we can kind of sink our teeth into. I want to dive a lot deeper into that model. But first, let's, as we like to do on this show, find out a little bit more about you for context.
Sure.
So, you know, tell us the Brian backstory, like what got you into all of this, you know, in terms of like starting at the beginning even, and then kind of leading up to, you know, your career path to today.
Sounds good. So my background is really bifurcated in two. So I spent sort of the first half of my career more on the technology side. I was a product manager at Microsoft for a number of years. Also worked with a couple of smaller firms. And then at one point said, you know, I like a lot of different business topics, not just the technology side. So I decided to bounce over to management consulting. And so worked for a number of years at a restructuring firm called Alvarez & Marsal. Mm-hmm. Then jumped over to Ernst & Young, where I worked with their private equity group. Advising private equity firms on acquisitions and strategy and operations improvements and all the sort. So really had this very almost nonsensical background for anything that wasn't entrepreneurship at that point. At about that same time, went and got my MBA from Wharton, which is where I met my co-founder, who we can speak a bit more about in a moment. Mm-hmm. And it was really there that she, who had worked in network news, saw the pain point of their sourcing raw video. And so we started talking about it and said, wow, this is a great opportunity to chase. I can kind of run product and finance and operations and combine all these otherwise random skills together into one. And she, of course, knew and understood the pain point of the customer really well. So that's kind of how we got to where we are today.
So that brings us to the present, but before we, I want to allow ample time to get into Stringer, but before we do that, I don't want to let the opportunity pass. While we are kind of talking about the past, whenever we talk to founders or co-founders on this show, we love to find out, you know, just various stories, you know, founder stories, the inception of Stringer, the early days, any of the challenges or lessons. I mean, that could be its own podcast, but if you want to zero in on a few kind of, you know, key learnings for our audience that maybe would be entrepreneurs, what kind of lessons did you take from that early period?
I think there are a couple of things. One is that getting things off the ground takes a little bit longer than you'd anticipate. And unless you have a lot of money in the bank, your best strategy is probably to continue working your day job during that. Mm-hmm. Certainly for the first, call it 6 months, while you're getting things off the ground. You can build your MVP in your evenings. You can kind of talk to early customers, you know, on lunch breaks and things like that to understand what they're looking for. And if you're on the right path, you can talk to early angel investors where you can carve out the time. You know, you don't want to you're already going to go a couple of years of below market pay, so you don't want to set yourself behind the eight ball too much at the early phase of that there.
Yep.
The second I'd say is, you know, you don't overpay on the engineering on the first wave. Now, many of your listeners may be great engineers, which is fantastic. They can save on that expense. You can get that MVP out of the gate fairly readily using offshore tech teams or offshore tech talent at a much lower cost to really understand whether you have something there and whether there is something you can run with to the market. So those are a couple of things we did right. Some of the things we did less well, I would say, one is the design side of things. You know, it's easy to kind of overlook design and say, look, we're aiming for functionality now. We're aiming for proof of concept. We're aiming to get things to work well. The challenge is, of course, investors and customers are making snap and quick decisions about the value and about the quality of your product, often off of somewhat, let's call it, less rational things. Hmm. And design is one of those. So, you know, if you have a functional product that looks less than stellar, you might actually be losing some deals out of the gate. And then similarly on the investor side, you know, I have never, out of hundreds of investor conversations, I've never had one look at source code. I've probably only had a handful even touch the product. It's strictly limited to a demo that is done in the room. And so what is important is that look and feel really kind of indicates the quality of your product that sits underneath it.
Absolutely. And you mentioned investors a few times. You also mentioned kind of the challenges and the tactics around bootstrapping. And that reminds me of the always kind of spectrum of bootstrapping versus venture investment, seeking venture investment. It's not always a choice, right? But in a perfect world, I always like to ask founders who have either interacted with venture capitalists or seed funding or actually taken it, really the viewpoint on that. You know, I'm here in Silicon Valley where it is like, you know, and I know you used to spend a lot of time out here in the Bay Area. You know, it's something that is in the culture as this kind of vanity factor. It's glorified. It's rarely talked about the potential downsides. I mean, there's obviously, you know, the dilution in equity. There's loss of some control. There's perhaps exit optionality that is taken off the table. There is, you know, my favorite metaphor is that, you know, VC funding is like jet fuel, right? And that's great if you're building a jet. But what if you're building, you know, a nice house or you're building a scooter, you know? That jet fuel will obviously be a kind of combustion risk. So after that kind of long setup, what are your feelings generally about that, kind of the pros and cons of outside funding?
Yeah, I think a part of it depends on life stage, I would say.
Yep.
If you are sort of early mid-20s, fresh out of college, your opportunity cost is relatively low. Sure, you can go get a nice job, to be sure, but if you want to bootstrap it for a couple of years, and while you see if it pans out, it's not like the income that you would have gotten during that time period is going to be so massive that you're stocking away a bunch of money in your 401k and you're buying a house with it. So I think at that phase, bootstrapping is not terribly a bad idea. Mm. I think if you are more mid-career, and, you know, let's call it over 30 and certainly over 40, and of the sort that is capable of starting a company, your opportunity cost is pretty high. You're probably walking away from a decent salary, and so you need to know fairly quickly whether the idea you have has legs or not, because it's otherwise, you know, return to your day job. Mm-hmm. And so with that framework, I would say is one decision point I would use to advise on whether you seek funding earlier, whether you try to bootstrap to get a little bit further along. The other thing I will say is that money also begets money. So people like to invest in things that are shiny and exciting and look like they're really going somewhere. Bootstrapping, that is an incredibly difficult thing to make to give off that impression.
Yep.
Your marketing dollars just aren't going to be there. Your extra dollars for that, putting the button in the perfect place, is not going to be there. All the various factors. Your office is, you know, going to be in a corner of a WeWork at best. I think there are other drawbacks with the bootstrapping that even can limit your ability to raise funding, even if otherwise you're hitting all the other marks. But what I will say is because you mentioned the Valley and fundraising, classic venture capital fundraising, you know, I think it's important to remember that that's not the only
oh, sure.
Sure. Money. Of course, family offices being another big one. And so, the ability to raise money in the valley, you know, kind of comes down to I'd call it one of a few factors that need to be in your favor, and a couple of them need to be in favor at any given time. Yeah, you know, one of those is, are you a previously successful or moderately successful entrepreneur?
Yep.
If not, there's a strike against you, so that you're going to have to overcome. Are you in the hot space of the moment? And the challenge is, if you try to build a company that today is the hot space, it's not going to be the hot space by the time you get it to a point where you get to speak to a venture capitalist about it. So there's a bit of luck at play there about whether you happen to have dove into the space that that is a current space where investment activity is really hot.
Yep.
And then third, you know, do you, and this is kind of a bit of more of a controversial one, but do you look the part of an entrepreneur? And I think with the fall of WeWork, we might be seeing some of the cracks in that.
Yep.
There is a personality type, and there is a resume sort that venture capitalists are very much drawn to. It is the, you know, Stanford engineer, ideally fresh out of school or shortly thereafter, who is particularly brash and in your face and looks like they're going to change the world. For whatever reason, there's a bias for investing in that sort of company. And so if you are a woman, if you're a minority, if you are over 30, if Stanford is not your undergrad, and yeah, I went to Wharton, so I have a perfectly solid pedigree, but even there, you can see that difference in terms of what they're looking for from an investment side.
Yeah, that's great. Those are a lot of variables that we don't often hear. I mean, it's optics. It's, you know, money begets money. Opportunity cost. That people always forget about opportunity cost. So that's great. So we're actually going to pause for a commercial break. When we come back, more from Brian.
Hello, everyone. This is Mike Bolin, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Brandify, which is Street Fight's parent company. It's a local marketing company that provides a range of services for brands with brick-and-mortar store locations. So that's everything from retail stores to restaurants and moving companies and banks and healthcare providers and several other verticals. And Brandify manages the digital outposts where most consumers encounter these businesses today. So we're talking Google Maps and Facebook, Yelp, Apple Maps, and Bing. And the name of the game is really to create a compelling presence on these sites and apps and to engage with consumers more effectively using advanced reputation management tools. And this is all really compelled by the fact that 97% of consumers regularly search online for local businesses. So brands today can't afford to be missing from all those channels or lack multimedia content or contact information or visible responses to customer feedback. So Brandify synthesizes and optimizes all these channels through a local marketing platform. And it's all about standing out and winning the loyalty and lifetime value of tech-savvy consumers. So to learn more, visit Brandify.com.
So we're back. My guest is Brian McNeil. So Brian, before the break, we were talking mostly about you, your background, your learnings, a lot of kind of fascinating thoughts that you've kind of picked up through your career to get to where you are now. So that brings us to the present. So let's go one level deeper on Stringer. You mentioned the kind of high level view at the top of the show. But tell us more about the company's kind of product focus and value proposition. And then also, if you can, any kind of high level operational stats for our kind of context.
Sure, absolutely. So you know, at the core, as I alluded to at the top, we allow media organizations to source video very, very quickly. And so the mechanics of that are such that we go and we recruit videographers all over the country, all over the UK and Canada as well. We have 100,000 folks. And the idea there being is we're very much trying to identify somebody who has high-end gear in their closet and would like to earn some additional money off shooting video and put in their part-time. The value proposition, though, is fantastic. So let's take a news customer. Let's take the local ABC stations who use us. They hear there is a story that they want to cover that is, you know, more than a few miles from their station. You look at their options today. They can roll a crew out there, even when those big ubiquitous trucks you see everywhere, and go cover it. And you've got your reporter, you've got your cameraman, you have fairly expensive equipment there. You have the time to get there and back and the parking and everything along with it. That is certainly important and critical for the big story of the day that they're doing deep reporting on. But there's all these nice secondary stories that fill the broadcast. We allow them to get those stories far more efficiently at far lower cost than they could do through their own direct means, but also we allow them to tell more stories. And so they can tell the story of the ribbon cutting that's across town, or the puppy parade, or the breaking news item that they might otherwise have to show a map on. We allow them to cover all those stories as well. And so we allow that sourcing of video very quickly. Now, that was the inception, and that was the idea behind the company, and that's really where our focus was for the first few years of the company. Of course, that network of videographers can do far more than just shoot news video. And so if you look at where we have evolved, it is now the core idea is, how do we make video production faster and more efficient for all parties? So at the top of that is your raw video that you need in. So you could be an advertiser who's looking for a shot of a sunset in Santa Monica. No need to fly a crew across the country to get it, or try to source a local videographer. You can just drop a pin on a map and request that. You could be a brand who's looking for some people using Tide at home, and you could drop that pin on the map and get all sorts of users of Tide sitting in their home. Basically, anything to make that top of that production flow far easier and faster, so you get more raw video in. And then on top of that, we've now layered a number of tools to make the full production flow faster. So we have a web-based editor that sits there. So these videos come in, you can then take those videos and drop them straight onto a web-based editing platform, no matter where you are. You can then publish that off to we partner with Brightcove. You can then, with a click of a button, publish that off to Brightcove. So you then have something that can be easily put onto your website and streamed to the world. And so it is every iteration we now go through is trying to figure out what feature or what do we need to add in order to make video production faster. Because we're moving very much, of course, as a world, if we turn to the industry side of things, that's increasingly bifurcated. You have the high end, the Netflix, the Hulu, the Amazon, the Apples, who are pouring more and more money at content. We're not going after those budgets. Those are the folks that can afford, the production companies there can afford to fly crews across the country to shoot what they need to shoot. But at the opposite end of it, whether it's pure digital, pure YouTube, or even local broadcast, or OTT channels that are kind of off in the hinterland and aren't named Netflix, all of those are going to need to produce video more efficiently than perhaps they have in the past, both because the monetization amounts might not be there on digital, or the revenue might not be there on the broadcast side. And so we are there to help them basically improve that production process.
Absolutely. It's interesting. The kind of on-demand / cost-saving streamlining for a given news organization aspects to all of this kind of remind me of what I've seen depicted in terms of some of the, I guess, old school structures that you're disrupting in some ways, like the movie with Jake Gyllenhaal. I forget what it's called, like Nightcrawler. Yes,
you got it.
That's very interesting in terms of, like, in those situations they were looking for lower cost, you know, and also kind of dangerous work rather than having their, like, main anchors go out there in the middle of the night. But no, it seems like it has some aspects of that, you know, that at least need that's been in place for a while, but of course a more streamlined and tech forward way of solving it. So to further kind of, I guess, characterize this, so on the creator side, you know, if this existed, for example, in the, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal's character in his world, you know, what are the options? It sounds like there are a few things. You can kind of, you know, be on that network and stand by for that on-demand work that will have specific parameters like an assignment, or kind of shoot video on spec, which then is, you know, perhaps added to your profile or your library in the overall network, when then on the demand side, they can kind of browse and grab things, whether it be, you know, B-roll, or whether it be just, in, you know, things that are, I imagine there's a taxonomy sitting behind it that allows them to make it browsable. So I guess there are several questions in there, but.
There are. Yeah, happy to dive in there. So you're exactly right. So the core of the platform is responding to these requests. So you download the app and you'll be notified of any video that is within kind of a geographic range of where you're standing at that time. Mm-hmm. And you can go shoot that video. You can shoot that video. It is on spec. However, immediately pass it along to our customer. And if they like it, they download it and you immediately get paid the next business day. But of course, you might happen to see something. It could just be a beautiful sunset, or it could be something that is more breaking news worthy. You can film it and upload that to the platform. Mm-hmm. In both those cases, you're providing the title, the tag, the description of the video you're uploading. And of course, we know your location thanks to GeoServices. And we, of course, know when you shot that video as well. all of that goes into our archive. So we now have 350,000 videos in our archive from our few years of existence, all tagged with that data. So you can literally dive in and say, let me look at Ohio 2018 keyword snow, and you can source video of that.
Nice.
And so it makes it, there's that long tail sales opportunity for the contributor that you never know when somebody's going to pick up something like that for some story that they might be running down the road. And then there's our next tier that is a little less obvious to the casual user, but it is what we call Stringer Pro. And so every video that comes to our platform, we are rating for quality. We also allow our videographers to provide additional information about what sort of equipment they have, for example. So we have a lot of additional information about these videographers. And so sometimes we don't want the crowd to go shoot it. We just need one person to go film it, an interview with the CEO, for example, or something in a hospital, or a brand shoot where you would just want somebody who can shoot really well and of a product. So in those cases, we'll assign it one-on-one, but it's entirely based upon a mixture of the profile and the geographic location of that videographer.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there are also some inherent advantages to the model that you've set up here, where after a while, a certain network effect can kick in, and also, you know, a certain content repository that as it grows and, you know, assuming that there's a strong taxonomy behind it, it can really start to get a flywheel effect going because it's kind of in very broad terms, it's, you know, a marketplace's model where you have a two-sided marketplace. So are you seeing that in terms of, and is that by design in terms of as it grows, it kind of, you know, its value increases?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, we have a deal with Stanford Library whereby their students can actually search our archive for academic research purposes.
Huh.
Because that, again, that sort of value of the archive, if folks can dive in and say, hey, I'm studying the Black Lives Matter movement. Let me log into Stringer. And you can actually look at, you know, the raw video clips that were captured for news organizations, various, you know, Black Lives Matter protests a couple of years ago. And so absolutely, the long tail there was kind of built by design. As an entrepreneur, it's a very interesting thing to build for that, because of course you're measured by your last quarter's revenue, and it's mm-hmm. instead you're saying, hey, by the way, in 3 to 5 years, this is going to be a tremendous archive that's going to have a lot of value in it. And you have to convince people to kind of come along with that. But absolutely, it's to the best of my knowledge, I think we are the single best repository of news video of anything from the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. You have the Associated Press and Reuters, who are both our partners and are fantastic, but they cover the big stories of the day. They cover where the present is. They cover the national story. We have that raw video of every local news story that's occurred over the last several years. And so it's pretty exciting to look at how people are going to be able to begin using that.
And that all seems to also lend to, in addition to kind of the long tail and some possible network effects, it lends to some business model advantages around, you mentioned, you know, Pro. Is that a subscription type of thing for frequent users? Because that also lends itself to some other key metrics these days, such as, you know, recurring revenue, of course.
All that good stuff that
yeah.
I was looking for. Absolutely right. Yeah, so let's talk through the way we kind of price it in broad terms. So we will go to, so let's say, a news organization. What we do is we sell credits to our platform. So those credits, it's, say, 15 credits to download a crowd video. This is a video shot by anybody on the street, but it might be 45 credits in order to download something that was to request and get back a pro video. So what we do is sell, in order to achieve that sort of MRR objective that, of course, everybody's looking to invest
yep.
in, we sign them up for year-long contracts with a certain amount of credits that are kind of doled out monthly against that, like a cell phone plan, if you will. And so that's how we structure that. So it's actually a very unique marketplace where on one side we have these fixed dollar amounts that are pre-negotiated with each of our customers. On the other side, we have a dynamic algorithm determining how much we should pay out in order to kind of fairly treat the videographers in each market and while also not overpaying and while still being sure that the request gets fulfilled.
Yeah, I imagine that varies by geography too, just based on, you know, different economies, just the supply and demand of work. So that's very interesting. So we're actually going to pause there for another commercial break. When we come back, more from Brian.
Hello, everyone. This is Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'd like to talk to you today about Brandify, which is Street Fight's parent company. It's a local marketing company that provides a range of services for brands with brick-and-mortar store locations. So that's everything from retail stores to restaurants and moving companies and banks and healthcare providers and several other verticals. And Brandify manages the digital outposts where most consumers encounter these businesses today. So we're talking Google Maps and Facebook, Yelp, Apple Maps, and Bing. And the name of the game is really to create a compelling presence on these sites and apps and to engage with consumers more effectively using advanced reputation management tools. And this is all really compelled by the fact that 97% of consumers regularly search online for local businesses. So brands today can't afford to be missing from all those channels or lack multimedia content or contact information or visible responses to customer feedback. So Brandify synthesizes and optimizes all these channels through a local marketing platform. And it's all about standing out and winning the loyalty and lifetime value of tech-savvy consumers. So to learn more, visit Brandify.com.
So we're back. My guest is Brian McNeil. So Brian, before the break, we were talking about some of the ins and outs of the business model, the product model, the buying personas, the two-sided marketplace, and all those dynamics. Now I want to go one level deeper. So you mentioned earlier you're constantly evaluating the model, seeing where you sit in the value chain, where there are opportunities for expansion. So I want to talk about, you know, your view of like what's next. Like that could be either vertical expansion or buying personas. You're obviously big in like news producers. Are there any other personas out there that are consuming or distributing video that are untapped? And then not just, you know, the supply side, but also any expansion in terms of where you sit in the value chain. You mentioned you're sending video to Brightcove. You're working on distribution tools and editing tools. You know, are you looking to expand your kind of place within the value chain to kind of adjacent areas that kind of work towards economies of scale and just kind of greater appeal and all that good stuff?
Absolutely. Starting with the news side, and there are a number of ways that we can help our news customers even further. And a couple of things that we're looking at there. One, we've just added live streaming functionality. So rather than just requesting taped video, you can now get a live stream out of these events. And so this is really, you know, playing into a lot of the technology trends. 5G, for example, we're very well positioned to take advantage of something like that, where we can now get, imagine, a 4K live stream of any event anywhere in the world with a click of a button. Is something that we're going to enable newsrooms to do. Beyond that, though, what we've realized we've done here is built a very powerful video production platform. And so at some point, of course, we looked at that and said, wow, there are a lot of things that could be done with this platform that our customers are slowly beginning to realize, but maybe we can nudge it along the market a little bit by being our own best customer in some ways. So we are also beginning to produce a lot of original news-related content ourselves that we in turn can sell to our various news partners to help them fill gaps they might have either on digital or in broadcast as well. So that's some of the other places that we're starting to move there. Horizontally, there, of course, as I mentioned earlier, a number of industries that can really use this ability to source video very quickly or the ability to produce video more easily. And so we are now working with some corporate communications departments to help tell their stories internally better.
Yeah.
We are also working with a number of advertisers who want to source more, let's call it realistic looking footage from a broader number of locations. For example, a MasterCard, a division that works with them, used us in order to source more video from more places for a campaign that they were running. And so there's a couple of places, and then also, of course, some of the sponsored content as well we're pretty well positioned to do because of our proximity to news and our adjacency to advertising. There's some opportunities that we're exploring there as well.
Yeah, and what about also, you mentioned the corporate communications department kind of moving kind of down market. In terms of that, what is your thought on like the long tail kind of SMB marketplace? I mean, that's one I've looked at for years, and there are several challenges from a sales perspective, from a lifetime value versus customer acquisition perspective, all that kind of unit economic stuff. It's challenging, but you know, it's a pretty big prize if you can nail it, right?
It absolutely is. We actually have toe dipped in the SMB space with product videos. And so folks who need a product, for example, for Amazon, for their Amazon listing, can leverage us to shoot that. Because we have this great network of videographers. If you want to see your product in use in the woods of South Carolina, we have the videographer who can shoot that very quickly and get that back. And so that's one place, but you're absolutely right. SMB is a huge opportunity. There is that price sensitivity there, which we of course can help with. But from an operationally side, it's of course more of a challenge because it needs to be much more self-service in order for the business to make sense. Mm-hmm. We've historically been an enterprise sales-driven company with highly experienced folks talking and training teams at the news and media organizations, and so there's a slightly different model that we need to do there to help those folks, and one we're kind of working through and developing now.
Well, one kind of middle ground between large enterprise and SMB are kind of franchises that are multi-location brands that have some co-op dollars or perhaps marketing assistance from the kind of centralized mothership. They're all kind of organized differently in terms of how centralized versus decentralized, but some kind of have the resources of a large company, but yet the localization that you could potentially serve.
I like it. Your commission check is in the mail.
Nice. Okay, so another thing that you mentioned which intrigued me is, you know, some of the technologies and how those technologies are positioning you and informing the evolution of your roadmap. You mentioned 5G in terms of how it enables live streaming. What other kind of macro trends are you looking at? I mean, there are some obvious ones like the, you know, Moore's Law. We have, you know, higher bandwidth accessibility. I guess that gets to 5G, but we also have, you know, mobile consumption. The degree of bits that are being consumed continues to increase. We also have things like drones, right? I mean, you see a lot of drone kind of videographers out there because the barriers to entry are low. What are of those or others are you looking at?
Yeah, there's a number of spaces there. 5G, of course, as we mentioned, the smartphone video cameras are getting better and better and better to the point where now we often have a hard time, if we just look at the video itself of what comes on our platform, determining whether it came from a higher-end camera or whether it came from a modern smartphone. Hmm. And those continue to get better. You saw with the latest iPhone demo, the ability to not just, of course, zoom 1x or 2x or 0.5x, but in the roadmap is to film all three simultaneously. And so you think about the power of something like that for Stringer, the ability to do a tight, a wide, and a normal shot all in one take. It could be pretty powerful and exciting there as well. Some of the other things that we see improving are these various tools that allow you to kind of clean up the video, whether it's stabilizing the video, whether it's improving the audio quality, things like that that can be done using AI solutions to really make that quality better without the need for an editor to spend hours kind of cleaning it up. And so that is the sort of improvements we see that very much play to what we're looking to do. Drones, of course, are always exciting. It's always my favorite video whenever we get drone video on the platform. And so that's another place that's pretty good. And then the flip side, of course, is the demand side. This is an incredibly rapidly changing marketplace. You have the broadcasters are going to be increasingly challenged over the coming years. But at the same time, a number of new opportunities appear at all times. There's, you know, whatever the latest social network of the year presents new video opportunities. The latest OTT channels present, of course, have huge demand for more video. And so there's this rapidly growing demand for content. Not all of it can be serviced by the high production cost offerings of the Netflixes of the world. And so it's that sort of that middle tier and more a small target tier that we're going after.
Absolutely. Then that's all the time we have. So I want to thank you, Brian, for spending time with us.
Lovely. Thank you so much for your time as well.
Yeah, this has been fun. So thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Also stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia from Street Fight. So this has been Heard on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.